Well, let me extend a warm welcome to those of you who have joined us tonight. This is an open lecture and kind of a standalone lecture, but it is also part of a conference that we've been having at the Andrew Fuller Center and the Canadian Baptist Historical Society co-sponsoring a conference on the theme of baptism war. And in a conference like that, given the whole experience of the Baptists in the West, obviously it would be very appropriate, as we're going to do tonight, to look at the experience of Baptists and the larger experience of Christians during the American Civil War. This is the sesquicentennial of the beginning of the American Civil War, which was the most violent experience in American history. More Americans died on the battlefield as soldiers during that war than in the entirety of the 19th century. Some 600,000 and more soldiers died during the American Civil War, running from 1861 to 1865. And many, many more in terms of who were civilians, an unknown number dying from disease, hunger, exposure brought on by the conditions of the war. If you want to look at it from another perspective to see something of the horror of that period of time, during one day, September the 17th, 1862, the Battle of Antietam, more Americans died on that one day in combat than in the entirety of the 19th century in all of the wars that America found herself fighting. And a big question that looms for the historian studying that period of time is why such ferocity and bloodshed, given the fact that as Abraham Lincoln said in his second inaugural address, that both sides read the same Bible and both sides pray to the same God. To help us think through the mindset of that era, particularly as it relates, obviously, to religion and to Christianity, it's our privilege to have with us Dr. George Rabel, who holds the Charles G. Somersell, Chair of Southern History at the University of Alabama. Dr. Rabel received his PhD from the University of Louisiana, and since that time has been involved extensively in writing on the period of the Civil War and that era, and has written most recently God's Almost Chosen People, A Religious History of the American Civil War, recently published by University of North Carolina Press. He is going to come and address us on the topic of, is the American Civil War a holy war? Following his address, there will be a very short break so you can stretch your legs. And then we have a panel discussion that will interact with Dr. Rabel's book. Dr. Greg Wills, who serves here as Professor of Church History, Chair of Theology and Tradition Department, will chair that panel. And he will introduce at the time the other panelists involved. So, a warm welcome to Dr. Rabel as he comes then to address us on, is the American Civil War a holy war?
Thank you, Michael. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening. I want to especially thank Michael for the invitation, for making the arrangements, and Steve for all the logistical work he did, to Ryan for kindly picking me up at the airport as I flew in today. I may teach at the University of Alabama, but I'm an LSU grad and LSU fan whose daughter went to Auburn, so I have additional Civil War expertise beyond simply my scholarly activities. And tonight, addressing the topics of war and religion and politics, I'm sure I won't say anything that will be controversial or anyone could possibly disagree with, so you can just sort of have your after-dinner nap, I guess. I'm a little bit mad at Michael for stealing my opening line from Abraham Lincoln about both sides praying to the same God and reading the same Bible, but I would add to that that they often read that Bible in remarkably similar ways, and that was another problem. More broadly speaking, I think it's fair to say that religious language and images and ideas were absolutely pervasive during the American Civil War. And in some ways, that seems surprising to people, I doubt that that seems surprising to this audience, but it may speak, too, to some assumptions we have, and certainly some assumptions the American public has about American religious history. In 1855, there was an attempt to estimate how religious the United States was, and the estimate was that out of a population of 27 million, approximately 4 million were members of some Protestant church. And if you throw in a million or two Catholics, you get some sense of the religious landscape at that time. In addressing audiences in various parts of the country on this question, I've noted that people often find those numbers rather surprising. They assume that they would be much larger in 1855 than that estimate. But I think in some ways, that estimate of 4 million, and even if you throw in the Catholics, is misleading. Obviously, there were many people of religious conviction who were not members of churches. Why? Well, in part because the standards of church membership were somewhat higher in that day than in our own. When my wife and I joined Forest Lake United Methodist Church in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, we had to answer a couple simple questions, and they handed us the offering envelopes. You know, it really didn't set the bar, you know, all that high. Now, I know you Baptists set it a lot higher, but we Methodists are, you know, sort of slackers in that regard. But in the 19th century, of course, if you joined particularly one of the evangelical churches, you had to not only be willing to probably give your testimony and perhaps have the members of the congregation vote on whether they believed you, but you also had to be willing to have your behavior fairly carefully scrutinized. So the bar was set considerably higher. So I wouldn't put a whole lot of stock in that 4 million number, but it gives you some idea, at least, of the religious landscape. If you look at the people of religious conviction in the 19th century, one of the things I think becomes obvious very quickly is there is a powerful sense of divine providence in looking at the ordinary events of life and also the larger story of a nation's history. There was a strong belief that the story of America was part of a larger story of human history, a kind of unfolding of providential design, and that certainly becomes apparent during the American Civil War. Now, we mere mortals could at times catch a glimpse of this larger meaning of history, but human history, both in its long sweep and also its messy detail, remained in God's hands. That is absolutely a foundational belief. And this kind of God talk, if you will, was very commonplace. It was part of the language of ordinary life. Now, I think with some Americans, it was more a verbal tic, maybe, than deep conviction, but certainly it was there. And so it's hardly surprising that millions of Americans would use their religious beliefs, and especially beliefs about divine providence, to interpret and understand the sectional crisis of the 1850s, which we could talk about in detail but won't, and the Civil War itself. Today, however, virtually all this experience is forgotten. In fact, it seems to me that the broader sweep of American religious history is largely forgotten, at least in the popular mind. We recently had the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And if you'll recall, in the aftermath of 9/11, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and I might as well throw in Jeremiah Wright for good measure, all offered providential interpretations of 9/11. In other words, they said 9/11 came about as punishment for sin. Now, they disagreed on which sins that the nation was being punished for. Not very grammatical there, but you get what I mean. And I noted in the journalistic coverage of this, I could not find a single journalistic account that acknowledged that this had once been a commonplace way to interpret important national events. People expressed their outrage or agreement or disagreement or whatever about what they said, but seemed to completely miss that this was part of an American religious tradition. Civil War historians have been particularly bad at this. We have, for the most part, and I'll confess to being a great sinner, hope to change my ways, we have generally failed to incorporate religion into the larger narrative of the war. Yet I think you could certainly make a case that in many ways the American Civil War was not only a holy war, but may have been the holiest war in American history, even though much of this is forgotten. If you look at the great narratives by Bruce Catton, by Shelby Foote, by Jim McPherson, you find religion hardly at all, which would have greatly surprised the Civil War generation, or at least many of the Civil War generation. So we begin with the idea of the war as a providential war. We look at the sectional tensions of the 1850s. We look at the sectional crisis in the winter of 1860-61 as providential, as a kind of punishment for individual and collective sins. And in this year of 2011, when we are entering the sesquicentennial, which is keeping a lot of us very busy, we need to begin at a little fort, just completed fort, in Charleston Harbor in South Carolina, Fort Sumter. Fort Sumter, by April 61, had come to symbolize federal authority in South Carolina, and by the same token, Fort Sumter was a terrible affront to Confederate claims to being a sovereign nation. It was the center of national attention at that point. Now, to the militarily untutored eye of young Emma Holmes, a wonderful diarist, Sumter looked, in her words, almost impregnable. But she took heart because, in her view, the Confederates had truth, justice, and religion on their side. And to many ardent Confederates, that was just the point. And when Fort Sumter was surrendered without the loss of a single life, this was nothing short of miraculous. Has not God, by this token, sufficiently declared his will? Asked a Charleston minister. And this minister, I might add, harbored no doubts whatsoever about the answer to his question. Now, of course, the Federals would have to wait a little longer for a similar sign of divine favor. But for the time being, the Federals had something that was almost as good. They had a Christian hero. The commander at Fort Sumter had been Major Robert Anderson, a slaveholding Kentuckian, but also an ardent Unionist. As early as January 1861, even before the fort had been surrendered, there were stories about Anderson kneeling in prayer as the American flag was raised over Sumter, reports appearing in the religious press. Anderson himself would later tell Sunday school children how he had asked the Lord to bless his men each morning. In his view, God had watched over them at Sumter, and they had been heartened by the prayers of Christian friends at home. And stories of Major Anderson's faith established him as a kind of model Christian soldier, defeated but unbowed, and seemingly bound for ultimate victory in this world and the next. Now, of course, the firing on Fort Sumter in April 1861 pretty well ended talk of peaceable secession, which had actually been pretty widespread in the months following Lincoln's election. We often forget how many Northerners were simply saying at that time, you know, let the erring Southern brethren go. There was a lot of sentiment on that side. One example, in Northampton, Massachusetts, on April 4, before the firing on Fort Sumter, a Congregationalist minister named Zachary Eddy had preached about the need for peace and conciliation. A week after Sumter, he had changed his tune. He said, even for Christians, there were times when war could not be avoided. And his first sermon preached after the firing on Fort Sumter was no longer a peace sermon. It breathed fire. The Prince of Peace, claimed one Iowa Presbyterian, did not preach peace at any price, and Jesus had taught his followers to resist evil with a sword if necessary. The New York Times not normally considered a thought of a source of deep theology, noted with great approval how the city's ministers had with one voice rallied to the side of the government in a just and holy war. And in some ways, I could end my talk right here and just say it was a just and holy war, and both sides thought it was a just and holy war. End of story. You'd all be happy. You could go home early, but I'm supposed to do some more, so we're going to keep going at this point and try to show how it was interpreted as a just and holy war. The shift in Southern sentiments after Fort Sumter was just as dramatic. After Lincoln's call for 75,000 militia, there were denunciations of coercion ringing from Southern pulpits, including pulpits that had disdained preaching politics before. Now, in the talk this evening, I've been asked to incorporate some Baptist examples, and I'm going to incorporate plenty of Baptist examples, but I'm also going to pick on my fellow Methodists, so I'm not accused of any sectarian prejudice here. I'll throw in a few Presbyterians and even some Roman Catholics, but most of the examples are going to be Baptists and Methodists. So we'll start off with some Baptists here. In the name of God, we set our banners, one Southern Baptist editor declared, quoting the 20th Psalm, and by the blessing of him who ruleth in the armies of heaven, the sword shall never be sheathed until the last invader shall be driven from our shores. A Virginia Baptist only hoped that Southern men would summon up the anger required to march in the battlefield and butcher the monsters that have invaded our soil. Secular editors often spoke in religious language. The Southern people could invoke the aid of the God of battles, one North Carolina editor declared, with a firm faith that he, God Almighty, will prosper the right. In fact, I think it's fair to say that on both sides, loyalty to the nation and loyalty to God became one and the same. Patriots needed only pray for victory. And virtually all religious groups, and I mean virtually all, embraced a providential interpretation of the war's events. Less than a month after the firing on Fort Sumter, a leading Quaker weekly observed that national sins, unless repented of, are always punished by national calamities. Even Unitarians talked of Pentecostal days. Now, I don't know about you, but I do not normally associate Unitarians with discussions of the Pentecost. This shows how dramatic this war was. In fact, the war was seen as divine judgment on the entire nation. And if that's so, what was God's purpose in this great war? And perhaps even more significantly, how could we discern the divine purpose? Well, one purpose clearly of the war was to punish people for their sins, which leads to the question, which sins? Well, take your choice. It's a multiple choice question, and the list would be very long. Collective sins, individual sins, was it slavery? Was it political corruption? Was it partisanship? Was it materialism? Yes. All of the above. But what about Sabbath breaking, profanity, drunkenness, gambling? Again, take your choice. The city of Tuscaloosa has recently approved Sunday liquor sales. Did it this spring. Now, if we were living in the 19th century and the horrible tornado that struck my town of Tuscaloosa had come along, you would make a connection between approving Sunday liquor sales and the tornado. No doubt about that. Or maybe erecting the Nick Saban statue. I don't know, something along those lines. These broad definitions of sin, however, significantly enough, crossed ideological and sectional lines. In our own day, we think of people of a conservative persuasion emphasizing individual sins. We think of people of a more reformist persuasion emphasizing collective sin. those distinctions would not have made a whole lot of sense in the 19th century. For example, many abolitionists believe that liquor is just as big an evil as slavery, and vice versa. Many preachers and lay people, North and South, compiled similar lists of transgressions, though obviously there were some sectional differences. There were some distinctive Confederate themes, for example. The Confederates were sure that the Lord was on their side because the federal Constitution was a godless document, which of course it is. There is no mention of God in the U.S. Constitution, even though I bet most Americans probably think there is. The Confederate Constitution, by contrast, invoked the favor of Almighty God. Therefore, the Lord must be on the Confederate side. End of story. There was even a wartime movement in the North to add some acknowledgement of God or even of Jesus Christ to the federal Constitution. The Presbyterians, or at least some Presbyterians, were behind this. It didn't pick up a whole lot of support, and Lincoln was distinctly cool to the idea. In the Confederacy, and again, our Presbyterian brothers, you know, deserve pride of place here, Southern Presbyterians favored official recognition of the Christian religion to be added to the Confederate Constitution. But Southern Baptists were wary about any move toward creating what they would have called a religious establishment. The Richmond Baptist Jeremiah Jeter, for example, warned that patriotism can be no substitute for piety. A certainly legitimate sentiment, and one largely ignored by people on both sides. Because all too many Southerners and Northerners would not have drawn such a bright line between patriotism and piety. Virtually all Southern clergy defended the institution of slavery, though certainly some acknowledged that slaveholders had fallen short of biblical standards in dealing with their slaves. And of course, the Northern clergy emphasized the sinfulness of rebellion with suitable biblical citations. Roman Catholics, however, are something of an exception. They offered a more conservative and less sectional interpretation of the conflict. In fact, Roman Catholic editors, especially in the North, argued that the war itself was the natural consequence of a nation that embraced Protestant principles. How could they say that? When you have Protestants, what do you have? You have schism and division. I don't need to say that to a Baptist audience. You all know about that kind of stuff, right? And these Catholic editors are simply saying, if we'd have been a Catholic country, there would have been no war. And of course, the Catholic Church does not divide during the American Civil War. However that might be, religious voices, whether Union or Confederate, seldom expressed very much doubt about the divine will at all. Surely God is on our side, wrote one Baptist minister's daughter, and she happened to be a Confederate, but her Yankee sisters would have expressed similar sentiments. They'd have just disagreed about which side the Lord was on. And even though pious young men and their families could sometimes ask whether a child of God could be a soldier, a question certainly addressed this afternoon, most churches and clergy didn't seem to stew very much about the question. They answered with a resounding yes. A good Christian could be a good soldier. In fact, would make a better soldier. Even a Georgia Baptist volunteer who was aghast at the spectacle, as he put it, of the most enlightened people on the face of the habitable globe daily killing each other by wholesale slaughter, he nevertheless concluded that all the butchery had been a chastisement to affect the purpose of the divine mind. In other words, it all conformed to the will of God. To a prominent Pennsylvania Baptist, it was simply inconceivable that the Lord would allow his greatly favored American Union to be destroyed by a rebellion. This type of civil religion was absolutely pervasive on both sides. And now I'm going to go after some of my fellow Methodists. For those of you that think I've been a little hard on the Baptists. I'm going to take after the Methodists for a little bit. The opening prayer of a New York Methodist conference came right to the point. Let's bow our head in prayer here. We ask thee to bring these men, the rebels, to destruction and wipe them from the face of the country. It's a Northern Methodist. But writing to his brother, a Southern Methodist minister matched this kind of blood-curdling rhetoric. It is a righteous war. I feel a deep Christian and inextinguishable hatred toward the demons of the North who would desolate my country and destroy its liberties. It is doing God's service to kill the diabolical wretches on the battlefield. Again, the distinctions between patriotic and religious devotion grew ever more distinct. A Southern Methodist called the Confederate States of America the last hope of freedom and the last home of the pure gospel. For its part, Northern civil religion was equally fervent. "We will take our glorious flag," declared Methodist Bishop Matthew Simpson, "and nail it just below the cross." And if you know anything about Bishop Simpson, you might suspect he might nail that flag a bit above the cross. Now, for sure, Quakers and Mennonites and other peace churches tried to maintain their witness against war, though they often did so very circumspectly. Quakers sought exemption from conscription. They received a rather sympathetic hearing from the Lincoln administration, but the cynic in me suspects that had the Quakers not been such a small church, they might not have received such a sympathetic hearing. What if the Methodists had suddenly turned pacifist during the war? I suspect Lincoln would have had a somewhat different attitude. Jefferson Davis was less sympathetic to Quaker pacifism than Lincoln was. And Quaker editors were careful. They never advised tax resistance, which would have been a direct confrontation with the government. And several Quaker editors acknowledged that a good many of their young people were caught up in the excitement. And not only caught up in the excitement, many young Quaker men actually enlisted in the army, which caused no end of trouble for some of the Quaker meetings. One study estimated, in fact, that 40% of young men who were Quaker in Indiana volunteered. So that suggests that the peace witness was indeed challenged. However that might be, everyone, including the Quakers, use their religious faith to explain the course of the war itself. Ideas about providence, the idea of war as punishment for sin, apocalyptic warnings about divine judgment, all of these become powerful and flexible ideas with which to interpret wartime events. Now, for sure, religion provides comfort to the anxious and the grieving, to the soldiers and their families, but it also offers an explanation for their experiences, for suffering and anguish, for victory and defeat, for the larger story of the war. Battles and their results become signs of divine favor. And we'll look at one example. In fact, the first major battle of the American Civil War, First Bull Run, or what the Confederates termed First Manassas, a prime example. And, of course, we had the 150th anniversary of this battle last July. At Manassas, a bungled Federal flank attack and fierce Confederate counterattack just north of Manassas Junction, Virginia, drove the Yankees skedaddling back toward Washington. There's First Bull Run in one sentence. I'm sort of proud of that. We Civil War historians have trouble, you know, talking about battles in short scope, but there it is in one sentence. The issue before us is not what happened at Bull Run, but how it was interpreted. For the victorious Confederates, the outcome of the battle itself becomes a sign, I bet you could fill in the blank at this point if you've stayed awake, divine favor. and this manner of explanation is commonplace for the rest of the war. But there's a tough question. What about all the brave and pious men who fell in battle? There was an assumption at the beginning of the war that the Lord would safeguard the righteous in battle. Many young men, when they volunteered, and their families assumed that if they were right with God, the Lord would protect them on the battlefield. But of course, that assumption was immediately called into question because obviously many of these fine young men were wounded or killed very quickly. Indeed, throughout the war, printed sermons, a wonderful source for studying this conflict, eulogized Christian soldiers who had faced death fearlessly, who had looked forward to reunion with their loved ones. And where would that reunion take place? It would take place in heaven. And I don't think it's any accident that during the American Civil War, Americans increasingly interpreted heaven as a place where your family would be reunited, where you'd see all your relatives again. I guess that's a good thing, depending on who you're, you know, what kind of relatives you have. A few of my wife's relatives, I'm not sure I'd be anxious to spend a whole lot of time with in eternity, but that's, you know, another question. Now, the letters sent home by chaplains and officers, along with countless articles in the religious press, reported the last words of soldiers declaring their faith during their final moments on earth. And these were deeply significant, especially in an age where, well, where did people die? They didn't die in hospitals. They didn't die in nursing homes. They died at home. And families cherished those final moments. They cherished the final words. They cherished an assurance that their loved ones had been right with the Lord. But now these guys are off fighting. They're being killed hundreds of miles from home. And so the only direct information they have come from these letters from chaplains and officers. And they cherish reports of their dying words. Interestingly enough, the deaths of so many fine young men, whether from wounds, and we often forget this, really more often from disease than wounds, these deaths did not seem to shake people's faith in divine sovereignty. As the Reverend Edward Reed told his South Carolina congregation shortly after the Confederate victory at Manassas, not one of these brave men has fallen or suffered without God's permission. And that is an important statement. Every wound, every death, represents divine intent. And regardless of denominational affiliation, many people firmly believe this. Indeed, this is not a surprising statement at all in an era where even during peacetime, people firmly believed that each death and indeed each illness conformed to the divine will. In the aftermath of Manassas, some folks believed that the Lord had chosen the field of combat, had supplied courage to the soldiers, and had even controlled the timing of troop movements and tactical maneuvers. In the words of a Georgia Baptist editor, the Lord had been the commander-in-chief whose unerring wisdom directed our officers. When I first started talking about this subject, a clever friend of mine said, why don't you call your talk God as General? A sort of play on the movie Gods and Generals. And it fits, God as General. By the same token, the Lord had confounded the mighty Yankee army, just as he had scattered the Assyrians, the Midianites, and the Philistines, keep the list going if you care to, in Old Testament times. So this first great battle of the war had seemingly vindicated the Confederate cause and even sent some commentators leafing through their Bibles in search for references to the Southern nation in prophecy. In fact, there was a very thick tome published during the war called The Southern Nation in Prophecy. I would not recommend it to you. It's rather turgid reading, but it's interesting. It's interesting in the selection of biblical passages. In fact, the smallest incidents in battle become signs of divine favor. People praying fervently back home for the men in a company who somehow emerged from battle unscathed. At Manassas, we had the first accounts of Bibles stopping bullets. Soldiers carrying testaments in their pocket, they stopped the bullet, and of course, they always reported the exact verse where the point of the projectile stopped. And that verse was always, you know, fraught with significance. Though I did find one Confederate who wrote home to his mother, he probably liked to twit his mother a little bit, and said, "It wasn't a testament that stopped the bullet, it was the deck of cards in my pocket." I'm sure she loved to hear that. But in any event, all it seemed that the Southern people had to do was to give God the glory and keep their trust in Him, and they would emerge victorious. Pious Northerners, not surprisingly, took a somewhat different tack after First Bull Run. "The judgments of God are upon us," declared one Presbyterian editor. The nation's leading Methodist newspaper, the Christian Advocate and Journal in New York, agreed that the defeat had doubtless been ordered by Providence as part of a severe but wholesome discipline, which in the end will cure some desperate evils that have existed among us. In other words, we're being punished for sin, and it will do us good. The Lord had long shaped the nation's history and would continue to do so. And as was typical after any major battlefield loss, and this applies to the Union and Confederacy as well, the defeated side tried to figure out which sins had stirred up divine wrath. When was Bull Run fought? I'm not asking you the date. I'm asking you the day of the week. It was fought on Sunday. But wait a minute. Both sides fought on Sunday, right? But those Yankees had attacked on the Sabbath. And that struck some commentators as significant. Stonewall Jackson, for example, the sort of ultimate Christian soldier and Presbyterian of Presbyterians, thought there was nothing wrong with fighting on Sunday as long as you didn't attack on Sunday. That may split some theological hairs, but we'll not worry about that. But it seemed that the failure to observe the Sabbath in camp, along with the foolhardy effort to launch an attack on the Lord's Day, had surely displeased the Almighty. Others blamed the defeat on swearing and alcohol. And of course, there was plenty of swearing in both armies, and there wasn't necessarily plenty of alcohol, but if the soldiers could get a hold of it, they certainly consumed it. This will shock some of you, but I've got to observe it in, you know, kind of a tribute to historical truth. Even Baptist churches discovered members not only consuming liquor, but manufacturing it. Yet Horace Bushnell, a prominent congregational minister and theologian whose name is probably well known to this audience, but largely forgotten by Americans in general, preached a remarkable sermon in the aftermath of First Bull Run called "Reverses Needed." We might phrase it differently. We might say defeats needed, which is what he is saying. Bushnell worried that the defeat at Bull Run was a warning to a nation that, in his view, had created a government without moral or religious ideas. Again, you have a constitution with no mention of God. Bushnell also declared that Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence represented nothing but godless theorizing. He said, no wonder the American Union must face reverses and losses, such as the Battle of Bull Run, because, as he put it, without shedding of blood, there is no such grace prepared. Now, Bushnell did not believe that the Lord had suddenly turned against the Union cause. Not at all. He believed that the North was fighting for just principles, that the North had God on its side. But he also believed that many more sacrifices would be needed to atone for national transgressions. And he used the word atone advisedly, and it's hardly surprising that in the aftermath of the American Civil War and all the bloodshed that involved, Horace Bushnell wrote a great deal about the atonement. African-American clergy, in the aftermath of First Bull Run, warned that the nation had not yet faced up to the sins of slavery. In fact, some African-American clergy debated whether Lincoln's call for a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer, issued shortly after the Bull Run defeat, should even be observed. Now, as a historian, I will herein throw in a footnote. I apologize, but I think it's a necessary footnote. Throughout the war, both Abraham Lincoln and the Confederate President Jefferson Davis issued fairly regular calls for days of fasting, humiliation, and prayer when the war was not going well, and for days of thanksgiving when the war was going well. So you have these sort of cycles during the war, and Lincoln issued the first of his right after this Bull Run defeat. Henry McNeil Turner, who would later serve as one of the first black army chaplains, described the dead at Bull Run as the bloody victims of slavery's hellish caprice. Indeed, many abolitionists of both races now argued that God would allow the bloodshed to continue until African slavery was banished from the nation. The progress of the war clearly indicates the purpose of God to be the summary extinction of slavery, an Ohio Baptist convention declared, and of course later on, Antietam, the bloodshed at Antietam, seemed to be proof of that proposition. The continuance of the war, and especially the mounting casualties and the suffering in the home front, seemingly challenged a providential view of the war's course. And in some ways it did, but in many ways it didn't. Because human beings could at best achieve only an imperfect understanding of God's will, and because biblical history proved that the Lord had often used heathen nations to punish his stiff-necked chosen people. You can make that argument on either side. Even in 1864, Federals and Confederates alike had not abandoned their versions of civil religion. The devout in both sections continued to believe that God was on their side, however inscrutable the Almighty's purposes might often appear. Of course, when you think about 1864, at least when I think about 1864, about all I can think about is horrific bloodletting at places like Wilderness, Spotsylvania Courthouse, Cold Harbor, Petersburg, all names that should resonate and depress us when we think about them. And these might have led war-weary soldiers and civilians to speak of pointless sacrifices. And many did speak of pointless sacrifices. It might seem logical enough for the clergy at this point to assume that the war had spun out of human control. Yet somehow each victory rekindles hopes of divine favor. And defeats could still be explained in terms of divine chastisement, the kind of spiritual discipline for whom God loved, a phrase that comes out time and time again. Now, at this point, it would be legitimate for you to ask the difficult question, to what extent did the soldiers themselves interpret the war in these terms? I wish I had a wonderful and definitive answer to that question. I don't. Let me offer some suggestions that you can certainly disagree with, because I could well be wrong about this and many other matters for that matter. There were widespread reports of indifference to religion in both armies, on both sides, early in the war. If you look at what soldiers are writing in 1861, they're saying there's no Sabbath in the army. I'm surrounded by heathen. People are drinking and gambling and swearing and worse. There was a lot of criticism of chaplains, not only early in the war, but later in the war. Interestingly enough, both the Union Congress and the Confederate Congress reduced the pay of chaplains during the war. And there were a number of politicians on both sides who suggested that they didn't think the chaplains were of much value at all. I think many of the soldiers would have disagreed, though the soldier reaction to the chaplains was also a bit mixed as well. By 1862, however, we read the first reports of revivals, especially among the Confederates, but also among the Federals, less well documented. The hope was that these camp revivals might win divine favor. If enough men are converted, this becomes a cause for renewed hope. In these revivals, it was hoped that sectarian differences would be forgotten. Though the Methodists and Baptists apparently sometimes sparred over proper modes of baptism. At one point, the Presbyterians and the Baptists got into an argument about this because the Baptists accused the Presbyterians of distributing tracts to the soldiers in which they were sneaking in ideas about infant baptism. And there was a series of editorial exchanges on this weighty subject. Soldiers themselves could sometimes sound like ministers in discussing the hand of God in battle. But of course, they also emphasized religion as a source of comfort. By the end of the war, there's a lot of conflation of individual and national salvation. As a number of ministers pointed out, a lot of soldiers believed that if they died in battle, they were sanctified, whatever religious experience they had before. And ministers might say this was heretical, but that did not seem to have a great deal of impact on many of the soldiers. Also, I think it's fair to say that toward the end of the war, especially for the Confederates, there was an increasing evidence on individual salvation and less talk about national salvation. Both soldiers and civilians could believe that peace would come only in the Lord's good time. Perhaps the nation had not yet been punished enough for its sins. And of course, ministers on both sides warned against the sin of murmuring against the civil authorities, against military commanders, and against God. And of course, there had been plenty of murmuring against all three during the war. For Confederates, maybe defeat with God was not so bad after all. And for the Federals, as the war neared its end, it seemed that the Lord had finally smiled in their cause. The day after news of Federal troops entering the Confederate capital at Richmond, the day after this news arrived in Washington, D.C., the United States Capitol was brightly illuminated. Gaslighted transparency was emblazoned with the message, "This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes." But we're now in 1865, and already the forces of the modern world and its relentlessly secular tendencies were putting great strains on this providential view of history. But this brings us not only to the conclusion of this talk, but to the war's ultimate meditation on the divine purpose. And that is Lincoln's second inaugural. The greatest speech ever delivered by an American president. If you don't agree with that, you're simply wrong. Far superior to the Gettysburg Address, I think. If you disagree with that, you're equally wrong. And in fact, I don't want to hear it. Throughout his political career, Abraham Lincoln, whose own religious convictions or lack thereof had been a source of considerable controversy when he was a young man, Lincoln had refused to render harsh judgments against Southerners, and he refused to do so during the war. Throughout the war, Lincoln had refused to automatically equate the Union cause with God's larger purposes. This also put him outside the mainstream. And even as Confederate armies were collapsing in the spring of 1865, as he's being inaugurated on March 4, 1865, Lincoln refused to yield to the temptation of gloating over this coming Union triumph. In his magnificent second inaugural, Lincoln somehow rose above many, though I think hardly all, of the pious cliches so popular in both the North and the South. He noted how both sides had not expected the war to last so long or be so bloody. Each looked for an easier triumph. We often ignore that line, but that's a good one. Each looked for an easier triumph. Don't we always do that in war? Oh, it's going to be easy. Troops will be home by Christmas. Each looked for an easier triumph. Then he says the prayers of both sides could not be answered. So is he going to say the prayers of the Federals were answered? No. He says that of neither has been answered fully. And then he makes the key point. The Almighty has his own purposes. You know, most human beings don't really want to hear that. We want to line up the Almighty with our purposes. At least I'm sinful enough to probably want to do that from time to time. Maybe y'all can avoid that, but I've had trouble sometimes. And that's not a very comforting message, particularly in the moment of triumph. Let's have some victory celebration, right? He then goes on to say, if slavery was such an offense to God that the war had to continue and that both the North and the South had to endure a terrible war, then Lincoln could only conclude in the words of Psalm 19, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Now that, I submit, is a very hard affirmation to make in the spring of 1865. Because by that time, over 600,000 Americans had lost their lives. And I'm glad Michael mentioned that in the introduction because I just started reading an article before I flew up here. It's going to be published in Civil War History pretty soon, a major journal of, you know, Civil War studies. It's going to push up that number to 750,000 based on census records and all kinds of statistical manipulations that I must admit I don't think I'll be able to understand. But anyway, 600,000 may be too low. Well, whether it's 620,000 or 750,000, could the friends and families of the dead simply say, thy will be done at this point? The Union victory and the Confederate defeat left many hard questions about providence and the role of God in human history unanswered, as Lincoln himself readily acknowledged. And Lincoln was willing to live with unanswered questions, or questions he didn't know the answer to. That, again, separates Lincoln from many of his contemporaries. But this whole idea of unanswered questions would at times deal a body blow to providential interpretations of history. And I think never again would an American war be interpreted in such openly religious terms, though we may disagree about that. Less than 2 months after offering his meditation on the war's meaning, Lincoln himself would fall victim to an assassin's bullet. Was Lincoln's assassination a providential event? Many people at the time thought so, but that will have to be a subject for another occasion. Thank you very much.